Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Recreational marijuana is now legal in 8 states and the District of Columbia. It's out there. It's for sale, above board. But researchers still say it's not good for developing young brains. So what's the right family conversation here? When mom and dad may be legally toking up and the kids are looking on, this hour On Point, talking pot with your kids in the age of legal weed. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Will weed legalization change the way you talk about drugs with your kids? Will you toke up while warning your kids about the effects? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Milwaukee is Krista Lisdahl, clinical neuropsychologist and professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her research focuses on addiction, adolescent brain development, and neuroimaging. She's done big work on the impacts of marijuana use on young brains. Krista Lisdahl, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Before we get into how people now talk about this, in the many states, 65 million Americans now live in states that have green-lighted recreational sale of marijuana. What about the impact on young brains? We read that there are impacts on development all the way up to age 25. Can you walk us through what is known?
Sure. Well, Tom, the first thing I want to say that it's important for everyone to understand that even though marijuana, or what I usually call cannabis, is a plant that's natural, it does have chemicals in it called cannabinoids like THC that mimic chemicals in the brain called endocannabinoids, like anandamide and 2-AG. And a lot of times people kind of forget that because it's natural, that it actually is a drug that goes into the brain and affects behavior. And what we see over time is if you use cannabis regularly, especially high-potency cannabis, we see a downregulation of that natural endocannabinoid system in the brain. And that natural system plays a really critical role in neurodevelopment, including during adolescence. So it plays a role in the fine-tuning of connections, in the white matter and the gray matter development, and as well as cognition. So if you use cannabis regularly, what we see in adolescence is some reduced cognitive functioning, especially in processing speed, overall IQ, verbal memory, the ability to sustain their attention over time, and some decision-making.
How big are these effects?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what we tend to see is a difference in about 10-15% of performance. So that may be a difference between a B and a C. So it's generally not severe deficits. They tend to be mild to moderate.
But a 10-15%, are you talking, when you said overall IQ, are you talking a 10-15% change in IQ?
Yeah, well, there was this one large longitudinal study by Madeline Meyer that found that kids who started using cannabis before age 18, at least weekly, had an 8-point IQ drop. And so that's almost a full standard deviation in IQ from their childhood IQ. And probably most problematic is they didn't see that even after stopping adulthood that they went back and reached their kind of projected childhood IQ. So it looked like the changes were more permanent. But that study has some flaws and we really need to replicate it. But it is alarming.
These are kind of astounding numbers. I mean, who would want to surrender 10-15% of IQ? What about the ages of most vulnerability here? We've read that there are developmental impacts all the way up to age 25. But take us through the curve of where the vulnerability is greatest, and does it taper off? How's it work?
These are great questions. So for the most part, the studies that have looked at age of onset, like my colleague Stacy Gruber out in Boston there, has found that if they start using, especially before age 16, we see much greater effects on brain structure, brain function, how the different brain regions communicate with each other, as well as resulting cognition. And then, of course, the longitudinal study that I just mentioned had the cutoff at age 18. Unfortunately, we don't have such fine-tuned data to say, you know, the critical age is definitely 15, 16. But the good news, Tom, is that there's this really large NIH initiative called the ABCD study that stands for Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development. And we're going to be following 10,000 kids throughout the country for 10 years. And actually, this is a huge study that's going to answer lots of questions. But one of them is, what happens when kids start using, you know, things like nicotine, alcohol, and cannabis? And we'll be able to tell with much more fine-grained detail what age is kind of the most dangerous period and what level of use, as well as what potency is most dangerous.
How firm is this research, Krista? I mean, you know, when you think about historically marijuana use during the many years in which it's been widely illegal in this country, our sense has long been of it as concentrated among the young. I mean, now with legalization, I'm seeing numbers coming out here saying that, you know, boomers and seniors are taking up pot at quite a clip. Even some numbers saying teen marijuana use is fallen. It's fallen sharply in Colorado, for example, in 2014 and 2015. This is the National Survey on Drug Use just coming out. Show it down even with legalization there. But historically, we think of the young as being kind of the center of marijuana use.
Well, the peak users are actually 18 to 25, the heaviest, mm-hmm. most frequent users. And then also that's really when the onset of cannabis use disorder starts. But the kind of first time that people are trying is getting younger and younger, and now it's between the ages of about 15 to 16. But you're right that the last couple years, following a really almost a decade of increasing use among adolescents, the last couple years have shown a decline. It's not unique to marijuana, though. I do want to emphasize that there's been a decline in binge drinking. There's been a decline in, you know, opiate use and stimulant use and pretty much every illicit drug that there is. And so this might be what's called more of a cohort effect, where that whole generation, for whatever reason we haven't totally figured out, have actually reduced their drug use. So that's great news. The other thing I want to say is that this is also good news. The majority of teens actually don't use marijuana. So among 12th graders, 36% do use cannabis in the past year, but that means the majority aren't. And that's really important for people to keep in mind.
When states have been talking about legalization, most of them have a minimum age for buying pot when it's legal in the 8 states and District of Columbia where it is now legal. But that leaves several years of what you're describing as vulnerability, according to the research. Did states come and ask, what about this? Was there ever a thought of making the, you know, minimum age of buying legal pot 25, or was that just considered ridiculous on the face of it?
Well, it depends on the state. I know that Washington was really asking a lot of scientists, and there were some scientists at the table in Colorado. I've had conversations with some states, and certainly from just the public health lens, the recommendation would be to set the age at 25, which is when most of the brain development has really been, for the most part, completed, and they're transitioning into more middle adulthood. And we do see fewer effects, say, in, you know, groups that are on average age 30. But for the most part, you might find that the policy is being made through a very different lens than public health. It's most of the policy is being drafted for more economic reasons.
I guess there's been a lot of booze out there for a long time, and booze is not all upside, that's for sure. Calls for you, and I want to turn in a moment to this issue of how families think about this and talk about this. Peter in Savannah, Georgia. Peter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Enjoying the show very much.
Thank you.
Well, this is a subject that's actually been very close to me, as I've been an advocate for ending the drug war for decades. And I was a fairly heavy marijuana smoker starting as a teenager up until about 3 years ago.
When you say fairly heavy, what do you mean? When you say fairly heavy, what do you mean, Peter?
Oh, probably Willie Nelson level.
Okay. Okay.
Daily smoker.
Okay.
Multiple times daily.
Okay.
Well, I guess if it dropped my IQ, that's what kept me out of Mensa, because I've always tested in the 130s to low 140s as far as my IQ goes.
Pretty high.
But this is something that, as far as the drop in usage, this is something that they noticed in Portugal quite a while back when they ended the drug war 12 or 13 years ago, that there's a certain amount of people that are really into drugs simply for the effect of booze. They tend to lose a lot of users anyway. But how long have these studies as far as dropping IQ and all these other negative effects been going on in the United States? Because marijuana is not a new drug, and it's always been commonly used as long as there's people, as far as I understand.
Peter, you sound like a smart guy. Are you skeptical of the research that Chris is laying out?
Just from, you know, decades of personal intensive research, I am a little.
Krista, what do you say? Peter, I appreciate your call. The line's a little rough there, but I'm glad for your call. Willie Nelson-level smoker for a long, long time isn't buying it.
Well, thanks, Peter. One of the things that he brought up was the Portugal model of decriminalization, and that's actually something that I really strongly support. That's quite different than legalization for a profit.
What is that model?
The Portugal model really focuses on depenalization or decriminalization. A lot of people use that term. So where there's no legal consequences for their use, but they've gone way beyond that, where they put funds into social services, wraparound services, really, people, for those people who are really showing substance use disorders. So they're providing housing, they're provided working training to try and get them back into employment. And it's they're providing counseling and therapy, as well as medical services. So it's a harm reductionist model that doesn't treat addiction as criminal behavior.
But also doesn't build a new big legal industry. Is that the deal?
Correct. So it's and that's where I have a little bit more of a problem. I'm not necessarily against legalization. It really depends on the policy. Where I have a problem is building another private, profit-driven industry with marketing and promotions and trying to push products on people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about legal weed and how it may change, may need to change, family conversations about marijuana. It may be legal, but there's a whole lot of research out there that you might want to pay attention to. Krista Lisdahl has been looking at that. She's a clinical neuropsychologist, professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, with us today from Milwaukee. You can join us this hour. Are you in one of these states where pot is now recreational use, is now legal? Do you have kids? How do you talk to them about what this means? Have you read the research that marijuana interferes with brain development until age 25? Do you tell your kids that? And what do they say? It's legal? Curious about what you see coming in your community, your state, your household. Are you going to have pot sitting around like a six-pack of Budweiser? Are you toking up while telling your kids to stop? Here's a little segment from this fall on NBC's Today Show. Matthew Padilla, college student, said kids know their parents are smoking weed and they're okay with it.
And a lot of parents smoke weed and their kids know about it and everyone's cool with it.
Here's the New York Times talking with a Colorado cannabis user and parent, Christy Lunford, explaining how she talks about marijuana with her son.
My son is very aware that we drink wine with dinner, and he's very aware that occasionally I enjoy cannabis with my friends, and occasionally when they're over, they'll be using cannabis as well, and that it's something that is for adults.
And here's NBC News Nightline reporter Juju Chang interviewing Jane West. This is a Denver mom, unapologetic about smoking weed, but also says she hopes her kids don't use until they're adults.
How would you feel if your kids started smoking pot?
The same way I would feel if they started drinking alcohol. We need to talk about substance use. They need to be responsible. And I truly hope that they don't start using substances until they're adults.
There's the hope. How does this conversation go? Krista Lisdahl, please stand by there in Milwaukee. With us now from Seattle, Washington, is Bruce Barcott, author, environmental reporter, editor. He's deputy editor of Leafly. It's a marijuana cannabis information resource site, kind of an advocate for pot legalization. Bruce Barcott, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, Tom. Glad to be here.
And with us from Denver, Colorado, Dr. Cheryl Ziegler, child psychiatrist in private practice. She talks with plenty of families about all of this. Cheryl Ziegler, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
All right. So there you are, Cheryl. You're in Colorado. Is this an issue? Do families come to you and say, How do we talk about this? How do we deal with our kids seeing legalization all around them? On the one hand, on the other hand, we've got the evidence that Krista Lisdahl's talking about, that this is not great, not good for developing brains all the way to age 25. What family conversation ensues out of that if people are concerned?
Yeah, I would say that there was certainly in 2014 a huge surge of talking to kids about this topic. And with family members, they certainly were confused. What do I say? At least I used to be able to say to my child, well, it's illegal, so how about that? You know, and that sort of would shut down a conversation. And now, really what's happening is the conversations are a lot more in-depth. And so instead of, you know, kind of maybe adolescents and their parents going back and forth and arguing about these things and then it just gets shut down, now they're actually talking about the effects on the brain and the risks and driving while under the influence. And so it's actually allowed, I think, for Colorado's middle and high school age kids to learn a lot more about marijuana than they had before.
Does learning about it mean that they're not using it? Or it's kind of hard to believe that greater availability wouldn't at some way be related to use, especially if you're talking all the way up to age 25.
Yeah, so, you know, I think a couple of things. The very first thing I think is that we aren't going to have really solid data for a few more years on the true, true impact. And I know we like to focus on data that, you know, is a year and kind of month by month usage and those kinds of things. But I really do think we need to see further down the road what the true impact, the overall impact is.
What do you mean when you say impact? Are you referring to Krista Lisdahl, the kind of research she's looking at about the developmental impact of cannabis on the developing brain?
No, I think that the science is actually quite clear, and I know that pro-legalization advocates like to sometimes debate findings in science. I don't think that we are uncertain at all about the effects on the brain, the effects on cognition, the decline in IQ points. I think we're all, at least in the medical world, we are all very clear that that's real. Certainly, again, the impact on the developing brain, and that means up until the age of 25. What I mean is more the impact on youth in our state, let's say, what is the true impact? I'm not sure that we're going to know that kind of data that I would feel comfortable relying and citing for a few more years.
Yeah, I mean, we've got this federal survey data saying, I'm reading here, this is Christopher Ingram with the Washington Post, teen marijuana use fell sharply in Colorado in the years 2014 and 15 after the opening of that state's recreational marijuana market. So there's that. On the other hand, it's relatively high use. Sort of the baseline was relatively high there.
Yeah, and I do want to be clear on that. I did read that. I know that it was, like a kind of a big headline in that way. And yep. I think there's a couple of things to know about Colorado. Number one, we have an extremely high use rate as it is. Very high adult use rate as it is. And so I think some of the things that, you know, either way, whether we're saying, oh, whatever the impact is on kids, I'm not comfortable saying anything really solidly until we have a few more years under our belt and really seeing those long-term effects. But I at least think that one of the positive things that has come out of this is there is much greater education, and we aren't waiting now until high school. These are middle school initiatives. So we are targeting sometimes fifth, but certainly sixth and seventh grade children and teaching them all of these things in a concise way. So I'm hoping that that really will have a very positive effect.
The conversation around marijuana cannabis use getting maybe more nuanced as legalization spreads in this country. It hasn't always been nuanced. Here's a little clip from, of course, the famous 1936 kind of propagandistic melodrama Reefer Madness, unexpecting group of American youths driven to depravity and suicide murder through use of marijuana. Pretty heavy-handed. As the film ends, the narrator warns that the next pot trauma might hit closer, the viewer closer to home.
Because it is only through knowledge that we can safely protect them. Failing this, the next tragedy may be that of your daughter, or your son, or yours, or yours, or yours.
Ba-ba, the 1936 warning there from Reefer Madness. But now we've got legalization and families, one hopes, talking about it. Bruce Barcott, you're there in Seattle. You've been an advocate for pot legalization. You're following what's going on. I think you've got kids as well. How do you think about this conundrum? It's going legal now in many places, but you hear the research on cognition and IQ all the way up to age 25. That is kind of scary. What are we setting up here? How do you talk about it in your family, Bruce?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I first of all, I agree with just pretty much 99% of what has been talked about in terms of cannabis and its effects on the developing brain. 4 years ago, I was not a legalization advocate. I was very much a legalization skeptic. I'm a middle-aged guy with two teenagers. I had a 11-year-old son and 14-year-old daughter 4 years ago when we legalized here in Washington State, and I had a lot of fears about what we had done. 4 years later, I have lived through legalization. I live in a legal state, and I have seen it work. I think my family's safer, and my kids are better informed. I thought when we first legalized, and I started taking notes. I'm a writer, so I mm-hmm. observe and take notes, and I thought that I would sort of go into this project of looking at all the science, all the medical research, and come out after a year and have an hour-long lecture for my kids and be a PowerPoint, and I'd tell them everything that's going on. And really, the conversation that happens is not a sit-down, one-hour-long lecture because the kids will tune you out after about 10 seconds. What happened was we ended up having this sort of running conversation that took place in little three-minute segments, whether it's on the ride to school, whether it's over dinner. And we would talk about why we were trying this project in Washington and in Colorado and what I was finding out about the effects of cannabis on the developing brain and why you shouldn't use it. A, number one, it's still illegal for you until you're 21. And B, the effects on the developing brain are real. That research is not a fraud. It's absolutely there. And these are considerations that, you know, we took into effect when setting the age of 21. And it's a consideration that, you know, you should take into effect when you're confronted with that situation, and you're going to be confronted with that situation, whether it's at a high school party or later at a college party.
I mean, Cheryl, there was always peer pressure among groups where marijuana was present. Is it clear whether legalization makes that higher or lower? And what about that gap between 21 and 25, where it's legal, but it's still not great for the brain?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the pressure certainly has always been there, and my hope is that now, since it's such an open discussion, like I said, even starting in middle school, that kids have some languaging. So in some of the presentations that I give, I really go over how would you handle it. Particularly, we talk about edibles, which are, I think, one of the biggest problems that we really have with this, and kids. So we talk about the different forms that THC might be presented to them in, and we talk about how to handle that. Of course, they always want to talk about alcohol. And so it really is enriching our conversations. And I do feel like we have kind of this new cohort of kids going out a lot more educated and probably empowered to be able to handle those things. I'm not a part of the 21 to 25 or just even, let's say, 18 to 24 where they're in college. And I feel like that's, that's why to me the data is important to look long term. I would say it would be difficult to impact that age group today, but we've got a new age group coming up that will eventually be young adults that will have had under their belt 4 or 5 years of education around this. So my hope is that maybe we'll start seeing those effects. But again, I think that's a few years out.
And you've got this phrase, I think it's yours, dare to delay. Is that like okay, it's fine, it's legal, but put it off. Don't go there. Wait till you're older.
Yeah.
That's mine.
Is that yours, Krista?
Yeah,
okay,
nice.
Dare to delay. I knew if somebody had it. Dare to delay. Does that work, Krista?
Well, you know, it's something that I put in a review paper, and it's definitely something that I talk about with parents that, I love how Bruce is talking about, and Cheryl, that they're talking about that these are conversations and you're talking in depth. And really, all the prevention research shows that you can't just sit there and lecture. You have to – it really starts with parenting, having a close relationship as well as high expectations and really talking honestly about this, and that can be very effective. But the reason I really focus on really delaying the onset is that making them understand that as they get older, the consequences are going to be less, and then they can make their personal choice. But when you still are at least a parent of a teenager that's in your house, you do still have a lot of work to do, and providing that scaffolding around them and that really close monitoring to not only talk about this, but be looking closely at their relationships and whether their moods have changed, whether you're seeing any signs of use, like, you know, the kind of red eyes or smelling it or using a lot of incense, and so that you can talk about this stuff and have a better idea of what they're truly doing before they start getting in a real at-risk period, which I would define as using at least weekly, you know, really consistently, maybe even daily, and they're starting to show some problems.
Mm. We've got a lot of callers who've been waiting to get in here. I want to go to them, if I may. Sylvie in Portland, Maine. Hi, Sylvie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, my story is that I have five boys between the ages of 18 and 21. Three of them are in college in Colorado.
Okay.
And one wants to go to college in Colorado next year. And I just feel that the statistic that Krista put out there in terms of the number of kids that endorse smoking marijuana weekly, or I forget exactly how often, 30-some percent, I find that, from my personal experience raising all these boys, really hard to believe.
You think it's higher, Sylvie?
I think it's way higher. And I think that my kids, my biggest issue is that they believe, they see the research, they've read it, I've shared it with them, and they claim that compared to alcohol, marijuana use is less damaging, and it has become a cultural phenomenon that they believe that it's really not that bad for them to engage in this as a, you know, recreational activity. The other point I want to make is that the number of kids that are getting marijuana cards is also shocking.
You're talking in medical marijuana states.
Yeah, in Colorado and in Maine. I have a friend whose 19-year-old son was given marijuana by his pediatrician for anxiety. And this is a kid who started smoking at that very, you know, vulnerable age, probably around 14 years old.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, it's just, to me, as a parent, it's been a really, really tough battle because my kids are well-adjusted. They do well in school.
Yep.
But they really challenge the idea that it's a bad thing.
Stand by, Sylvie. Krista, what about, first of all, the five sons? And the argument that comes back is it's better than alcohol.
Sylvie, five sons. I have one son.
Admiration.
I can't imagine how you do it. much respect. For one thing, the fact that they and you think the rates are higher is not shocking at all. In fact, everyone thinks it's higher. We actually use that as an intervention in schools. We ask teenagers, how many people do you think are drinking? How many people do you think are using pot? And they always just grossly overestimate, even when we have the actual data from their school. So it is truly, like, most of them really are not using or haven't used in the past year.
Is it safer than booze? If you're going to do something, and I'm not saying they should, but
Yeah, I mean, I would say that alcohol is clearly worse. And so I agree with that. But it's kind of like, you know, getting in a car accident is certainly worse than getting in a bicycle accident. But I still want my kid to wear a helmet.
It's worse. Are you going to lose 10 to 50% of your IQ drinking booze?
Yes. The cognitive effects of alcohol, especially binge drinking in particular, are very clear. And the effect sizes tend to be larger than what we see with cannabis, but not for all things. Like, for example, cannabis affects processing speed and sustained attention much worse than alcohol. So there's some... And also some of the emotional functioning and stress response has been stronger effects in cannabis users. So the effects are specific to the drug and really based on the neuropsychopharmacology of the drug. But I do agree. Alcohol is the biggest health problem that we're facing, including in youth. But I just don't think that it's a wonderful argument for saying that marijuana, therefore, is safe.
Sylvie, good luck with five young guys there. And we hear it's been maybe a tough argument to make. We also hear the mom looking out for their cognitive skills down the road. Those are useful for a long, long time. Appreciate your call from Maine. We're going to come right back to more calls here. Krista Lisdahl in Milwaukee, please stand by. Dr. Cheryl Ziegler in Denver, Colorado. And Bruce Barcott with Leafly joining us today out of Seattle, Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this about legal marijuana and how it may change, need to change, family conversations about cannabis. It may be legal, but there are still consequences here, and how do you have that conversation when it's legal? 8 states plus the District of Columbia, recreational use now legal. That's 65 million plus Americans. We'll see what happens if and when Senator Jeff Sessions is made Attorney General of the United States. He's spoken out against marijuana use, and of course, the federal government could still come in here and make some big problems for states that have legalized. But as of right now, there it is, and you may have different generations in one household looking at it with different consequences, looking at it in different ways. Krista Lisdahl is with us this hour, clinical neuropsychologist at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Dr. Cheryl Ziegler is with us, a child psychiatrist in private practice in Denver, Colorado, where, of course, it's been legal for a while now and big business there. Bruce Barcott is with us from Seattle, Washington, also legal, of course, deputy editor at Leafly. It's a marijuana and cannabis information resource site. People thinking about it, people talking about it, people becoming okay with marijuana use. Stigma fading here. This was on the Today Show this fall, and Jamie Perino, owner of the Euflora Marijuana Dispensary in Denver, says her clientele is now skewing older. No stigma.
Whereas before, it was a hush, it was a whisper. You know, people didn't want to use the word marijuana. But now it's definitely mainstream, and people are becoming more okay with it.
And when you've got the older generation using it, what does that communicate? How does that communicate? Here's a little clip from Viceland TV, their series Weedicate. Jessie, suburban mother, describes how she prevents her kids from using the weed she keeps in the house.
The message I tell my kids about marijuana is that it's not that much different than the other medications that are in the pill bottle. So just as they would never touch my pill bottles, they would never touch marijuana.
Let's hear from our listeners, Jamal in Detroit. Jamal, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say, you know, I grew up in Detroit. I'm fortunate enough somehow I didn't come across alcohol and marijuana until college. So blame it on college.
Okay.
And I grew up with friends who, you know, there would be weed smoke in the house. You know, there would be weed smoke maybe blown into their younger siblings' face and stuff.
Yep.
And I couldn't help but think the effect, it's got to have some type of effect, you know, developmentally. And now I'm 40 and I'm entrepreneur, own 3 businesses, wife and 3 kids. And I'm really fortunate that I didn't come across it until I was an adult.
So what's the conversation you would have with a young person in a state where it's legal, it's not, you know, not illegal, and yet we're hearing from Krista Lisdahl about impacts?
Well, I had a conversation with my son. He's about to be 12 in a few months, and so this was maybe about a year ago.
Yeah.
He stumbled across some things, and so I explained to him, you know, this is just, it's like driving or alcohol or voting. It's an adult thing. It's not allowed. It's not even, there's no compromise. There's no tolerance until you are an adult and can make adult decisions and adult consequences.
Jamal, that's very straightforward, and that's kind of what Krista Lisdahl is saying, dare to delay here. Good luck with it. You sound like you're on top of it. Bruce Barcott, does a message like that work when there is such, at the same time, a culture and a message of use among this very age group, the young?
It does. You know, it's also a starting point. You know, you can talk about the age limit as a cutoff and said, no, absolutely not, because it's illegal for you. But that's okay. But you really got to start talking about why we have these age limits. I mean, I have a 14-year-old son now, or I'm sorry, he just turned 15 last week, 15, and an 18-year-old daughter. And my 15-year-old son, you know, he knows where the car keys are. He knows how to drive a car, or he could probably figure it out in about 5 seconds. But he also knows that that's not for him, that we have these age limits for driving, for using alcohol, and now for using cannabis. And they're there for a reason. And we talk about that. We have had conversations about, why we have these seemingly arbitrary cutoffs where it's okay at 16 plus one day to drive a car, but not at 16 minus one day to drive a car. There's another thing that I want to go back to that phrase "dare to delay."
Yes.
It's a great one, because one of the ways that this conversation develops is not from our schools or our public officials. It really happens parent to parent, and we pass on these phrases like this because other parents come up to me all the time and say, "Hey, listen, how are you talking to your kids about this? Because I'm baffled. I don't know what to say." And I did the same thing 4 years ago. I had a friend in Colorado who had kids who were just, a little bit ahead of mine, and I said, "Listen, how did you handle that conversation?" Mm. And he said, I took a page out of Nancy Reagan's book. He says, I said, "Look, don't say, I'm not going to ask you to say, just say no. I'm going to ask you to think about saying, just say not yet." And in a similar way, dare to delay. It's like, this, you can try this, but wait a little longer. And here's why we want you to wait. Mm. And it's that approach that has actual evidence and facts behind it and reasoning that is happening more and more among parents of my generation out here.
Be kind to that brain. Joel in Boston. Joel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just curious, anything in moderation is usually tolerable and not as dangerous. You could do a million things too much and it could cause, problems. Mm. Why with weed is there there sort of seems like there's a hypersensitivity towards it when, clearly with alcohol you could drink until you die, whereas like smoking, it's not so clear. So I was just curious on what your panel has to say about that, and just like how it's not nearly as lethal, but is, it's sort of being treated as such. And I was just curious. Thanks.
I appreciate the question, Joel. Krista Lisdahl, what about a, all things in moderation attitude toward marijuana use in the young when it comes to brain development? Is there a happy medium here?
Joel, I agree. This is a really good point. Cannabis is not associated with overdosing like alcohol is. And so you're right. It's very rare to see acute deaths because of cannabis. Unfortunately, we don't know the cutoff. I mean, I do know in my research that the adolescents and young adults who smoked, maybe 5-6 times in the past year, we really don't see any effects. And in fact, we call them non-using controls. And I wouldn't expect there to be effects long term because it's not enough use to be actually down-regulating the endocannabinoid system in the brain. I mean, you have to be using enough that you're going to switch that natural neurotransmitter system in your brain. Now, of course, there can be negative effects of drug use because it's associated with, kind of sexual risk factors and drugged driving, and there's some safety things to talk about that with that. But I think this brings up that your response with your kids really needs to be mapped onto what they're doing. If they're using here and there, they've tried it a handful of times, then I would more so be talking about risks when they're using, how to stay safe. With my daughters and son, if they're making sure that they're not in sexually risky situations or that they're not driving home. If they're using more regularly, then the conversation's going to be a little bit different about how it might be impacting their sleep, their mood, and brain development. If they're using really regularly and showing, problems like craving and withdrawal, then I'm going to be talking about addiction treatment.
Where's the border between, did I hear you describe some kind of tolerable or safe, moderate usage and brain impacting negative usage? Where's the border?
Mm-hmm. Well, all we can say right now is that the studies where the adolescents and young adults are using at least weekly, and usually they're using at least a few times a week, all the way up to multiple times a day, they're the ones that for the most part are showing the cognitive and brain abnormalities as well as mood problems. The ones that are using, maybe once a month or much less than that, we aren't as likely to see any problems. There is a dose-dependent relationship. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this really large-scale ABCD study that's just following healthy kids throughout the country can start to answer those questions with more depth.
Joel, good luck to you. Libby in Berkeley, California. Libby, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I bring a different slant to everything. I was raised in Europe, in the Netherlands, and this thing about the decriminalization, and I guess it was the same with alcohol. You know, we had wine at the table every once in a while, and I would taste it. I didn't like it. Yuck. But there wasn't this allure of, ooh, let's go and binge drink like there is with the young folks here in America. And I'm a grandmother. I'm raising an 11-year-old granddaughter, and I unfortunately, for a while, was using medicinal marijuana because of breast cancer, and everything is fine now.
Good.
But my 11-year-old, you know, I remember having a conversation with her. She came outside, and I was smoking, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I had to explain to her. Well, I told her, I said, I feel bad. You know, this feels wrong to me for some reason. And she says, Grandma, it's medicine. And so at 11 years old, you know, she realized that that it can be used for a medicinal purpose.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have that fascination toward it. I ask her, you know, we talk about what's going on in school, what are other kids doing,
yeah.
and why aren't you interested in that? Oh, well, nah, it's almost like I've seen it and it's not that attractive to me.
So kind of regularizing it, understanding it as medicine. And of course, I think we can hear her compassion for you there at the same time, Libby. But she won't be 11 forever. There may be an age at which she has a different attitude.
Right, right. And that's where I love that dare to delay. And, you know, she understands about, you know, the gentleman before talking about the car and driving. She absolutely has no interest to do these things earlier. I don't know if it's just her or but I think exposure. You know, we have friends that have farms, their kids drive the trucks around and everything like that.
Yep.
My granddaughter's not the least interested in it. You know, I remember when I was going to get my driver's license, I couldn't wait. I made my mom, you know, swear a blood oath that she was going to take me. But my granddaughter just is not interested. Her exposure to these things, I think, have caused her to just, there's no allure.
So some more normalization that might take it away from the kind of allure. Libby, I really appreciate your call from Berkeley, and I'm so glad about how that all worked out for you on the cancer front. Cheryl, I've got here a note from Mark. He says, if I'm having a glass of wine or beer at home, I'll let my kids have a small sip. I look at this as a way to help remove the mystery of alcohol, make it not so much of a thing. They know it's for grown-ups, but I try not to act like a hypocrite about it. Now, if I decided to start smoking weed at home, am I going to give my kids a tiny puff? Many may equate the alcohol with the weed, but I just can't do that. What do you say, Cheryl?
Yeah, I don't see it as comparable, and I think that those of us who are trying to educate kids are really actually continuously trying to separate the alcohol-marijuana link. I understand it's perfectly normal for us to go, well, this is what we do with alcohol, so is this what we should do with marijuana? But really, the approaches are quite different. And so, you know, here, first of all, alcohol is consumed in one way. It is, you know, you drink it.
Yep.
And marijuana is consumed in so many ways. I'm losing track. Everything from
edibles
vaping,
and vaping. Yep.
Vaping, edibles, oils, soaps, I mean, wow. Tampons, everything.
Oh,
I mean, it's
wow.
Just really, it doesn't sort of end. It's every, I feel like every month I'm learning a new kind of something new that someone's created. So I think that makes it really quite different. And I think that that's one of the things that you can, part of the education and talking to your kids is to say, hey, when it comes to alcohol, it's very clear what it looks like and what even maybe it smells like. It'll smell like something different. Maybe you've never smelled before, or if it's wine or beer, you maybe have smelled it at home. However, marijuana is very, very different. It can be in so many different forms. Drinks even here. You can be walking around with what just looks like you're drinking a Red Bull, but really it has THC in it. So I think that that's what makes it very different for me, and really trying to have parents like shift gears a little bit, because we know alcohol so, so well, and that's very normal for us to think of our own childhoods and think of our parents drinking a glass of wine or whatever with dinner. That's something we can relate to. This issue going on today is not something that we can relate to for most of us almost at all.
When you, did you say marijuana tampons? I mean, when it's in so many forms...
Yeah.
What's the message? Does it normalize in a way, as our caller from Berkeley says, that leads kids to be able to talk about it and say, that's not for me? Or does it just become omnipresent and unavoidable?
Well, I also think that it gives you the opportunity. I mean, truly, when there's soaps and there's bubble baths and there's, you know, you can put it on your tongue and it'll dissolve in 2 seconds. And then there's tampons and there's all
these. Do you get stoned from all those things? Bubble baths? Like...
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And so what, and you know, and these are, we're talking about really concentrated doses as well. So you also, even for adults, have to be so regulatory. Like, you know, I'm sure everyone's heard of the lollipop or the gummy bear. A gummy bear probably has 4 to 6 servings in it. Well, who eats just the head of a gummy bear? You know, that's not normal, right? Or chocolate chip cookies have 4 to 6 servings in them. I mean, who eats one little
So what's the message for the kids in that environment, Cheryl?
I think that's when you say to them, this is something that is actually so out of our control. It is not regulated the way you would expect with a glass of wine. And this is why you have to wait till you're an adult and really be educated about the consumption of THC in any form.
Krista, what a situation we're setting up here where you can't, you know, a gummy bear and you're off to the races. It sounds like a tough one in which to really follow through on moderation.
Yeah, I think that's one of the more negative side effects of this kind of profit-driven model where then you're getting the concentrates that are incredibly high, you know, 40, 50% THC doses that my heavier users have transitioned to.
Bruce, final thought there?
One of the things we're trying to do with legalization is cutting down on underage access and allure. And we've done that by cutting down the black market, which wants to sell to kids. And frankly, the kids now are a little bored of it. It's no longer as alluring as it once was.
Gummy bears doesn't exactly sound like gummy bears sounds like kind of kid friendly, but we'll see. Much more conversation on this to come. Really grateful to the three of you for being with us today. Bruce Barakat in Seattle, Dr. Cheryl Ziegler in Denver, Colorado, Krista Lizdahl at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Our great thanks to all of you, and best of luck to all the families out there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.